is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Ultimate culture is what you allow and what you don't allow. It's just the way we do things every day, and you have to establish that in every single drill and every single practice.
Mike Winters is currently the boys basketball head coach at Harlem High School in McChesney Park, Illinois. He's also the author of the new book, The Journey, Lessons from the Hardwood. Mike has spent 18 seasons as a varsity basketball coach at Oregon, Rockford Jefferson, Rock Falls, Boylan Catholic, and McChesney Park Harlem in the state of Illinois. His career record is 357-164, good for a .687 winning percentage. He opened his career with 14 consecutive winning seasons. Coach Winters has led three different programs to the state tournament in Illinois. Coach Winters has been named the IBCA District Coach of the Year 7 times and was the Sauk Valley Newspaper's Coach of the Year in 2006 and the NIC-10 Coach of the Year in 2016. His teams have won 7 conference titles, 8 regional titles, and 4 sectional titles. He led his team to 9 20-win seasons and 2 30-win seasons. Coach Winters has coached players who have gone on to play at Kansas State, New Orleans, Florida A&M, Evansville, Southeast Missouri, Ball State, Wisconsin-Green Bay, University of Illinois-Chicago, Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and Air Force, plus many others who have competed at the Division II, Division III, and JUCO levels. 2 of his former players are now college head coaches. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Tim Hoyer from 180 Coaching, and you're listening to Hoopheads podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads mentorship program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at Hoopheads Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Are you tired of overpaying for your video and analytics platform? Well, it's time to check out QuickCut.com, a platform built by coaches for coaches. QuickCut is undeniably more affordable, it's all cloud-based, and comes packed with features to help high schools and youth programs store, share, and analyze game film. Make the switch, get double the storage, and save your program up to 50% on the fastest-growing video editing system in the country. For more information or to request a free trial, visit quickcut.com/basketball. That's QWIKCUT.com. You'll want to have your notebook with you as you listen to this episode with Mike Winters, boys basketball head coach at Harlem High School in McChesney Park, Illinois. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Mike Winters, the head coach at Harlem High School in the state of Illinois and author of the new book, The Journey, Lessons from the Hardwood, an excellent book, as Mike and I are going to dive into. If you are a coach out there, you're definitely going to want to listen to this episode. Mike's going to drop a lot of knowledge on us, and you're going to want to pick up a copy of the book. Mike, first of all, welcome to the Hoop Heads Pod.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I see you guys are over 300 of these things now, so it's cool to be on with you guys.
We're cranking them out. We keep working hard to try to get as much content out there to help the coaching community as we possibly can. We're thrilled to be able to have you on. Got a chance to go through and read your book here, kind of prepping for the episode. And I have to say, very, very well done. As people are going to see from listening to the episode, the knowledge that you're going to share, I think they'll see that it's more than worth them going out and picking up a copy. So that being said, give us the quick synopsis of the book, where people can find it, what it's all about, why you decided this was the time to write a book, and then we'll dive into more of your story and get into the nitty-gritty of the book in a second.
You know, one thing that I just have a passion for, and I think I was very lucky as a young coach, is I just had some really good mentors, some guys that you know, I could bounce ideas off of or learn from and just vent to as a young coach. I started when I was 20 years old, so I really wanted to kind of pay it forward and put together everything I've learned in 27 years of coaching. And it's not just X's and O's. It's actually very little X's and O's. It's really more about the off the court stuff, building culture, you know, the all in commitment of your family for young coaches who really don't know what to expect as they dive into this. But I think, you know, at the same time, there's a lot there. If you know, I think the best coaches are always in a growth state of mind. So I think there's a lot there for the veteran coach as well. I don't tell you what you should run. I tell you, I go through and just a lot of Q&A stuff that you just need to go through with yourself to try and figure out really what your philosophy should be, you know, in terms of the style of play and what you enjoy and things like that. I think that's really important too. I think it's gotta be stuff you enjoy because you're going to pour so much time and effort into this thing. And, so really it's a guide for the young coach, but it's hopefully some nuggets for the veteran coach as well. And I think, you know, you nailed it. I think people at every level can take some stuff away from it. And, you know, I tried to really tie in some anecdotes, just stories. I've been fortunate to coach against some great players, to have coached some great players and great teams and just trying to share some of the things I've learned, not only, you know, as a coach, but things that I've learned from my players and from assistant coaches and, you know, really everybody I've come into contact with over 27 years in this.
I enjoyed reading the section about Sean Livingston and thinking about him and that gruesome knee injury that he had when he got drafted in the NBA by the Clippers, and what a unbelievable athlete that people who maybe only knew him in his time at the war with the Warriors when he was athletically compromised from what he was. And so it was interesting to hear you, as somebody who played against him in high school, you know, coached against him and had the opportunity to see him when he was at his athletic peak. I really enjoyed reading that story. I thought it was interesting just you talking about how you had to think about trying to stop a guy who ended up being the fourth pick in the NBA draft and probably was headed for, if you think about what he became as a role player when his athleticism was taken away by that knee injury, you think about his IQ and just the way that he played the game. And if you would have combined that with the athleticism that he had pre-injury, what kind of player he would have been. And those are the kind of stories I think that really bring your career and what you were trying to do with the book to life. And I just wanted to say again, I really enjoyed that piece of the story. As I said before we jumped on the show, Mike and I were talking with Jason here, and I told him that I really feel like for our audience, this episode is going to fit almost identically with the way that Mike structured the book, in that he has some biographical information on himself, some background, and then he dives right into some coaching nuggets and things that can help you to be a better basketball coach. So that's what we're going to try to do tonight, is just follow sort of the arc of the book. And my first question related to you and your background is, when did you know for sure that coaching was what you wanted to do? Obviously, you got into it at a young age, but when did coaching get on your radar as, hey, this is something that I might want to do for my profession?
You know, that's a great question. I think it's funny. I teach career development too. So I teach, you know, kids about learning the job search process and exploring careers and all that stuff. So for me, I was a business major to start. I was planning on playing at a junior college here in town at Rock Valley Community College. I broke my hand, couldn't play. And then on top of that, I had to do an interview of a of a coach as I'm for a PE class that I had at the time. And I went back and interviewed my old high school coach, and he didn't have an assistant at the time. He's like, "Are you interested in coaching?" And I couldn't play. So I'm like, you know, yeah, I think I would be. I was 19 coaching 17, 18 year olds at the varsity level. And just fell in love with it. You know, I changed my major immediately to education, and the rest is history. But just had a really good opportunity as a young guy, and took advantage of it. And like I said, just it wasn't really sure what I wanted to do up until that point. And then, you know, I always tell kids, like, you don't know until you know. You gotta have some experiences. And just fell in love with it. Just being back around the game after being out of it for a year just felt really good. And I kind of knew that I just didn't want to be without the game in my life anymore. So that's kind of where it started.
One of the themes that runs through the entire book is the importance for you of your family. And it comes through loud and clear in a lot of the stories that you tell. And you frequently talk about trying to make sure that as a coach, you have balance in your life between your dedication to your team and your family that's waiting for you at home, your kids, your wife, your spouse. And when you think about how you changed as a young coach versus how you are today in terms of the amount of delegation you do, the time, and again, these are things that we can dive into a little bit more. But one of the things that struck me was you talked about being a young coach and having 3-hour practices and always going right up to the bell, and versus now your son has a game and maybe practice ends at 6 and his game starts at 6 and you got to leave 20 minutes early and you delegate that to your assistant. So maybe when you think about just the way that you've changed and evolved as a coach, what would you say is the number one thing or one of the things that has really changed for you since you first started in your career?
I think, you know, I fear failure. Like for me, I think a lot of people, you know, they're talking about the addiction of winning and all that stuff. And for me, it's really, I just hate losing so much. And, you know, as a younger coach, I probably just wasn't confident enough to allow people, you know, I didn't delegate well. I tried to do too much on my own. I probably watched too much film, you know, forced the kids to be at practice too long. And I think a little bit of that when you're young is lack of confidence. And I think it's something I really want to talk about in the book, because I think a lot of young coaches struggle with it. I sit there and I have an assistant coach right now, Luke Tassoni, who's fantastic. He's got 2 young kids at home, and, you know, and I kind of coach him through, like, these are things I made mistakes with. And one of the things that changed for me was I took a year out of coaching, and I took a job as a financial advisor. And I love the financial side of it. I hated the sales side of it. I really missed the game. And I had an opportunity to come back to one of the best programs in the state of Illinois at Boylan Catholic. And, you know, when I went back, my wife kind of gave me the look like, all right, you know, you're coaching your kids' teams now. And I promised her that wouldn't change. And it hasn't changed. I've coached my son's travel baseball team for years, coached him in travel basketball. Now I coach my daughter's 13U travel softball team. And, that's a big commitment, but it's, you know, my assistants are fantastic. I trust them 100% to take things when I've got to take off. And I think one of the things we miss as coaches, you know, we're always trying to feed life lessons to kids. I think that's the bigger picture. You know, we get caught up in wins and losses, and I do too, man. I know what my win-loss record is all the time. We all do.
Yeah.
But I think the bigger picture is you know, when I leave early, I tell the kids, look, I'm not going to miss my kids' game. I said, I think, your biggest role down the road is, as much as we want you to win basketball games right now, is going to be as a parent, as a leader. And if I don't show you what that looks like, then I'm not doing my job. So leaving early for me it wasn't always that way, but it's become just an example for the kids. You know, we need these guys to be great parents, because, you know, society needs that right now. We need all the great parenting we can get. And we have the opportunity, obviously, to really impact these kids and show them what that's all about.
Absolutely. I think there's no question that it's something that we've talked about with a lot of coaches, Mike, here on the podcast, trying to figure out what that, and again, I don't know if balance is the right word, but trying to figure out how to juggle doing the things that you want to do as a coach for your players, with your team, and maintaining what you need to have at home with your kids, with your spouse. And it's something that coaches struggle with. And I would guess that you've seen this in the profession, because we've certainly seen it here, that the amount of time as a baseline that you have to spend, I think at any level of basketball, but certainly at the high school level, the amount of time that you have to spend not only in season, but also out of season continues to go up and up and up every single year because the expectations of parents and players of having the gym open and getting in and getting skill development workouts and making sure that you're at summer league and just all the things that a high school coach, maybe right at the time when you started your career, might've been things that some of the best or most dedicated coaches were doing. Now it's kind of like, that's the baseline and coaches are trying to figure out how to navigate that with their family life at home and trying to make sure that they keep on top of both things. And it's a challenge. And I like the idea that you've talked about in the book and that you just shared with us there that look, sometimes you got to leave early and you got to have a good relationship with your staff and you got to be able to delegate. And those are really important things that are going to enable you to have the kind of success that you want to have both on and off the court as a role model, as you said, for your players. Because ultimately, yes, we want to win games, but it's about more than that. And it has to be. And that's one of the things that you talk about in the book is that it has to be about more than basketball. How do you go about making it more than basketball with your players and with your team? Being a role model for your players with your family is obviously one, but give us some other things that you've done over the years with your team that's helped them to see that this experience is about more than basketball.
Well, I think, there's just so many opportunities along the way. The journey is what it is. And there's going to be nights that are rough and you got to overcome adversity. It might be some calls that don't go your way. It might be shots just not going down. It might be an injury, whatever it is. And, I constantly remind our kids, like, look, this is hard, but man, real life is this and so much more. I mean, every time you face something difficult in real life, there's a lot more at stake than a win or a loss in a high school basketball game. So I think there's just opportunities to connect the dots there and, constantly remind them like, hey, we push you. We're very detail oriented. We're very demanding, but it's not about the result of a Friday night. It's about the results that you need to get down the road in your bigger, more important role, whatever that is and whatever you choose for that to be. So I don't know if there's any one, I don't know if I have any one just nugget or words of wisdom there other than this, seize the opportunities to talk about real life. I mean, we've all experienced it. We've all had family members come down with, diagnosed with cancer, somebody that dies unexpectedly. Difficulty of losing a job and how you're going to go on and you can't just throw in the towel, people are depending on you. And, they're 18 years old, they're pretty close to that. They're not too far off from those responsibilities.
Yeah. That comes quicker than we all think.
It certainly does.
We can think of that with our own life and you can think about that with your kids and how quickly those 18 years of their life can go by. People tell you that when you're kids are first born. And then all of a sudden I turn around and I got a daughter who's a senior and a son who's a sophomore and a daughter who's a sixth grader. I'm like, I still remember when they were little babies holding them in my arms. Well, it doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
And that's the thing I was going to tell you about, coaching your kids and making time for all that stuff. That stuff goes by so fast. I mean, my kids are a junior. I got one that's going to play for me this year. My daughter's an eighth grader. So I'll have them both at our school next year together. And it goes by so fast. So I tell people ask me all the time, like, how do you do all these things you do? How do you still coach travel softball, which, by the way, is more year round than high school basketball?
I believe it.
I just tell them, like, we can sleep when the kids move out of the house. We'll have plenty of time to catch up on naps and all that stuff. And just enjoy it while you got it, because, it goes by fast and it's just something you can't get back. You can keep doing this coaching thing until you're old and gray and fat, but those kids are – their time is limited in your house and you need to enjoy every second of that.
Yeah. And you said something similar in the book that when you said, when you talk about your own kids, that you talked about your players and you said that high school players, they get whatever it is they get. If you start when they're a freshman, they get 4 years of a high school basketball experience. And most of them as a varsity player probably get 2 years and you could potentially coach for 50 years. So you got to make it about the kids. And I thought that was something that is really important. And it's something that I think coaches are much, much better about that today than I think the egos are smaller in coaching today because we all can kind of see what the other people are doing. Nobody can hide behind closed doors and pretend to be a genius, because social media and just the openness of the coaching profession, I think, has made it easier for everybody to see what everyone else is doing. But I think it was a great point. Like, when I read that, it really struck me that, you know what? It's so true that you only get one chance as a player to go through and have your junior season or your senior season. Whereas for us as coaches, we're going to have another year next year, or another year the year after that, or another year 10 years from now, if we keep coaching, and the kids have a much more limited window. And I think that's something that is important to keep in mind as a coach, when you think about the type of program, the type of experience that you want to provide for the kids that you're coaching. To me, that seems like it's really, really important. That being said, in your career, you've gone through and you've coached at 5 different schools. As you said, you took some time to get into financial planning / sales, which you didn't like the sales aspect of it. But tell us a little bit about what you've learned in terms of getting a job and some of the things that a coach might need to consider if they're going out on an interview, or what they should be looking for in their next position. If maybe they're an assistant, they're trying to get a head coaching job, maybe they're a head coach and they want to get to a better program or find a place that fits better with them. Just what are some of the experiences that you've had in your career around changing jobs and starting a new program at a new school?
Well, for me, getting that first job was tough because I was pretty young. I thought I was ready when I was 23, 24. I started interviewing for head coaching jobs, and you know, everybody looks at you like you're 23 or 24, you know? So it's, I felt like I learned that I had to go above and beyond whatever I brought into the interview room. You know, I wrote a kind of a book or a manuscript, or it was probably about 100 pages at the time, just called Building a High School Program, and laid it all on paper. Like, this is what we're going to do. This is what each level is going to do each day, kind of all that stuff. And I felt like I had to do a lot more because I didn't have a ton of experience. I was a young guy, and that, you know, that can be a knock against you a lot of times. So, you know, as far as changing jobs go, and I think that, you know, what you were just hitting on, this is about the kids. This is not about you. And I think that applies to this as well. When I've changed jobs, I think, let's talk offensive philosophy, first of all. I think we all, you know, our first head coaching job, we have this vision, right? The things that we love to run, it's going to be great. We're going to go in and we're going to run all of my stuff, and it's going to be the most awesome thing in the world. And then you get there and the kids can't do half of the things you want them to do because they just don't have the skill set. So, right. You know, one of the things I said was, you just got to kind of get over yourself. All right, what can we do? And let's tweak it. And so our system is different every single year. And I think a lot of coaches do that now. But I think when I was younger, I did things because Bobby Knight did them or because Coach K did them. And I think that was part of my lack of confidence. So, you know, being able to legitimize something by saying, you know, Coach K does this, kind of made me feel better about it. And I could tell that to the kids and like, this is why. And, you know, it didn't really make a lot of sense at the time, honestly, if we were doing things that didn't fit our system. It's not what we were doing offensively and defensively. So, you know, I've just learned to just analyze things a little bit differently. But I think, man, you just really got to watch your game film. You know, the kids will show you and tell you what they can do just based on what you're seeing on film. So make sure you're putting them in a position to be successful. There will be a time where you'll have that dream team and you'll get to run your stuff, and it'll be, you know, it'll be everything you thought it is. But in between there, you got to make sure the kids have the best chance for success. And that's not always going to be with the stuff you thought it was going to be. You just have to be flexible. You got to be willing to change. I took a job at Rock Falls High School in Illinois. Rock Falls was, they had one, at the time, Illinois was 2 classes when I took that job. They had won a Class A state championship a few years before. They had been downstate or really close to state every year since then. And then they found out they were getting bumped up to the big school class, which in Illinois was everything from like 735 to whatever. I mean, we had schools with 6,000 kids in it. So their coach left. I had been riffed from my job at Rockford Jefferson High School right after we had come back from taking 4th in the state, and was just kind of tired of that. My wife was teaching down near Rock Falls. So I'm like, we're going to check this out. And man, it was just old school kind of sold out gym every night type place where they were just crazy about basketball. But when I got there, I was hired kind of late. So it's the first week of June and I'm just meeting the kids. And I didn't even have it really planned, but I'm like, you know, I kind of like our first workout together in the summer. I'm like, hey guys, why don't you just show me everything you guys have been running the last couple of years? And man, they must've been running 50 or 60 sets. It was insane. I had a legal pad full by the time the day was over with. And if I'd have known they were going to break that much stuff, I would have got the video camera out. But I'm sitting there trying to write it all down. And I just would kind of make a note. I like it. I hate it. You know, whatever. But we saved probably half of their system. They were good at it. I mean, this was a really good team returning, you know, six or seven seniors who all played a ton of minutes. And they were just super talented and high IQ and all this stuff. I was like, why am I going to come in and screw this up? These guys are really good at it. So it wasn't what I had planned or intended going in there, but it just made a lot of sense. And it kind of put their, you know, they were in a tough spot. Think about it. Here they are thinking they're going to be the number one team in the state next year. And they would have been in Class A, which is a small school class in Illinois. Their coach leaves. They get bumped up to the big school class. And now they're sitting there like, here we are as seniors, and it's the walls are caving in on them. And I think that kind of really helped them be comfortable with the change and all that other stuff. And the other thing is I had just taken fourth in the state in Illinois at the time with two classes. I think there were 375 teams in our big school class, and we took fourth. So I was able to come back and just say, look, you guys have what it takes. I just got back from there. You guys have what it takes. You can't get caught up in the size of your school and people telling you can't because of the size of your school and all that stuff. So I think that really got us off on the right foot. We ended up making it to one game away from state. We lost to Schaumburg High School, who had an enrollment of about 3,000 to our 740 kids. But, you know, I learned a lot just from them, honestly. And I've told a lot of people, like, you know, just when you take over, let the kids show you what they've got. You know, if they've got some things they're already good at, why not keep a few of it in? And it'll just help them transition.
When did you feel like you had the confidence to be able to do that, where you could come in and not just say, hey, I'm running Bob Knight stuff, I'm running Coach K stuff, I'm doing this drill because I saw somebody else do it? But when did you feel like you had the confidence to be able to do the things that you needed to do to maximize your personnel? And obviously you're always growing, you're always learning, and no, none of us are ever satisfied with where we're at on that learning curve. But when did you feel like you had a handle on, I can do the things that I need to do to help put my kids in the best position to be able to win, and have an understanding of how that fit into your own philosophy?
I think about my third year as a head coach. I left Oregon High School, which was a small school that I started at. We won, I think, 39 games in 2 years there. We did okay, and went back to my alma mater, which was Rockford Jefferson. And I knew I wanted to do things differently. I had been an assistant at Jefferson for 7 years, and I knew there were some things I really liked about what we did there. There were some things that, after being at a small farm community like Oregon in Illinois, you know, I realized that we didn't have to cater to kids. That you know, there are kids out there who would run through a brick wall for you still. And you know, maybe those kids that didn't want to do that, we just needed to push to the side and move on. So when I got back to Rockford Jefferson, that was that first year we played Sean Livingston. That first year, we were talented. We were pretty young. We had all kinds of attitude and egos and just a lot of chemistry issues. And I think we cut probably our three most talented point guards, to be honest with you. The kid who we kept as our point guard was probably the fourth most talented kid. He wasn't bad. He's a head coach now in Detroit, Michigan, at Lawrence Tech University. And I'm excited. I actually get to go watch him coach for the first time this weekend. We're heading up to Detroit.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
Six hour drive. So he wrote the forward in the book, Josh Pickens. And Josh was just everything we needed. You know, he was going to run the offense. We had tons of talent. We didn't need a point guard that would even wanted to score a lot. The kid ran the 100 meter in about 11 seconds. He could just fly up and down the floor. He was just a tough kid and high character kid. And you know, so we kept Josh, and we cut three kids that just, you know, were ineligible. They had all kinds of off the court issues, and you know, the culture there had just been, we're going to take all these talented kids and we're going to try and change them. And you know, there's something to be said for that in some cases, but man, you can lose a lot of valuable time on kids like that as well. So those are tough decisions that as a coach you're going to have to make at some point. And you just got to kind of go with your heart on it. You know, it's not to say I haven't tried to save some kids here and there, but for that team, that was the right decision. There was too much talent there anyways, and it just wasn't going to work.
What do those conversations sound like when you have to have a discussion with a player who maybe is more talented than a player that you keep, but has off the court issues or has grade problems or whatever it might be? When you sit down to have a conversation with that kid, if they come in your office or a parent comes in and says, hey, why is my kid not making it? How do you handle those kinds of conversations? I'm sure you've had difficult conversations in your coaching career. How do you go about handling those?
You know, brutal honesty. And generally, I'll leave clues, but I'm not just going to, you know, wait and say nothing and then pull a kid in and cut him at tryouts. I'm talking to him in August, September, October, you know, just this is where it's at, checking grades, giving them feedback, giving them the opportunity, because, you know, I think that's the big thing is that kid can change tremendously from one year to the next. Kids mature at different rates and you just never know when things are going to click for a kid. So, you know, that's not the first time we've had a conversation about whether or not it's going the right direction or not. But I think brutal honesty is something that kids have come back and told me they've respected a lot. You know, we didn't pull any punches. We told them exactly what they needed to hear. But I think that's, you know, the precursor to that is they got to know that you care about them as people first to be able to do that. And if you're a young coach and you're just trying to be brutally honest with kids and they don't know you from anybody, they're going to take it the wrong way if that's the case. So you do have to take time and build relationships with kids. If you do that, you kind of have that open door to be able to tell them the truth. And I think most kids want to hear the truth, honestly, but they want to hear it from somebody they trust. And that's the key. And it takes time to build that trust.
It absolutely does. And I think that's one of the challenges, especially for young coaches, is getting to the point where you can have those brutally honest discussions and have the kids respect your opinion, respect what you have to say. But as you said, you have to build that relationship first. And I think sometimes those of us, when we're early in our career, that can be difficult. It goes back to the confidence thing that you talked about. Yep. In order to be able to have those brutally honest conversations, you got to be pretty convicted about what it is that you're about to say if you're going to take a kid's opportunity to play high school basketball away from them by cutting them. You better understand exactly what it is that you're saying and feel confident that what you're saying is the right thing to do, both for your program and ultimately, hopefully, for that kid, to give them maybe an opportunity to go do something else, or maybe to come back if they're an underclassman, to work on their game and come back and give it a try again in the ensuing years as their career continues. I want to dive into a couple sections of the book that I think are really, really relevant to helping coaches out there to improve in what they do. And one of the sections that you have in there is, it's not what you teach, it's what you emphasize. And I think this is a really important thing. It's something that we just had a couple of podcasts where we've talked with several coaches about this exact point. And I'm coaching my daughter's sixth grade travel team. And we had our first practice on Monday. And before practice started, I've spent a couple of days going through and trying to figure out, what is it that I want to emphasize? Because I'll be honest with you, Mike, I'm one of those guys that I'm completely scattershot. Like, I'm all over the place when I'm working on a drill, and I'll say all of a sudden I'm correcting this and I'm finding that and I'm trying to do this. And then before you know it, I'm like, I really didn't accomplish anything that I wanted to, because I'm trying to fix everything. And so this year I decided I was going to make a huge point of trying to figure out, what are the most important three things on offense? What are my most important three things on defense? And that's really all we're going to zero in on. So just talk about when you learned that in your career and why you feel it's so important, and the experiences that you've had with making sure that you emphasize the things that are most important to you.
I heard that a lot from one of my mentors, who's actually my brother-in-law now, Dean Marinetti. I told you I coached 1 year with my former head coach in high school, and then he was let go after that year. Like to think it wasn't my fault, but he was let go. And so my future brother-in-law comes in and takes the job. And, that was something he said a lot. It's not what you teach, it's what you emphasize. And then I heard it at some clinics too, when I was younger, quite a bit. I think, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we have a lot of stuff as basketball coaches, right? We got sideline out of bounds. We got baseline out of bounds. We got end of game stuff. We got all this special situations stuff. And through all of that, is there a clear message coming back? Like you just said, what I love what you just said about three things on offense, three things on defense. You know, what type of clarity do you have in your practice plans? Do you have that stuff written at the top of your practice plans, the things that you're really focusing on that day? And then film yourself at practice, mic yourself up at practice. I don't need to be video. Just mic yourself up at practice and listen to yourself. What are you saying over and over again? What message do you think the kids are taking away? And then this may be oversimplifying things, but ask the kids what they're hearing you say. You know, just, hey, what are you hearing us say a lot as coaches? You know, and if they're not spitting back to you the things you want them to, then obviously you need to be able to, you need to change the way you're emphasizing or how you emphasize your most important points. But I think, you know, sometimes when you start off your season, the to-do list, you got 2 weeks for your first game and that to-do list is so long. I know exactly what you're talking about feeling scatterbrained. We got to do this, we got to do that, and not really getting things focused down. Here in Illinois now, we get 25 contact days in the summer as well. So that really helps us be able to kind of get our bearings as far as putting that stuff in for the next year. That's helped a lot. But, you know, and then ultimately, I think, you know, one of my favorite things is just winning as a byproduct of doing things the right way every day. So what are your procedures? What are your expectations on a daily basis? How much do you hold kids accountable from drill to drill? And are you consistent with it? Like, is it, I don't feel good today, so I'm not really going to get after them today on this or whatever it is. You've got to be consistent and demanding with your accountability. You know, that ultimately is your culture. You know, there's so much out there about culture now, and it's, you know, it's become a big ticket item, right? It's, there's podcasts, there's books, there's everything about culture. Really, ultimately, culture is what you allow and what you don't allow. You know, it's just the way we do things every day. And you have to establish that in every single drill and every single practice.
How do you help your kids to become a part of that culture in terms of enforcing it? How long do you think that takes when you come into a new program to get it to where it's not just coming from the coaching staff, but it's coming from the players, where maybe your upperclassmen are talking to your younger players, or maybe the one senior is talking to another senior and say, hey man, come on, we don't do that here. We're not missing a week's worth of summer workouts because X, Y, or Z. How long do you think that takes in your experience? And I know obviously it changes from time to time, but what are some of the things you do to help to make it be a player to player culture as well as a coach to player culture?
I think one of the best things that we've done is we have the kids write a vision statement, and we give them some examples. You know, there's some really, Jeff Jansen's wrote some great books about team building and culture, and he travels all and just touches the best programs in the country in terms of D1 schools and stuff. So I would encourage people to read a little bit of Jeff Jansen and just kind of, he's got some great stuff on vision statements and, you know, core principles, standards, whatever you want to call them. But we write a paragraph. That's our vision statement. Our varsity guys write that paragraph, and it's a cool process because we'll kind of guide it. We'll introduce it, and then we just kind of sit back, and every once in a while we'll guide it down a certain path. But I think it's really cool watching them debate their reasoning as to why they want this in and why they want that in. And, you know, we'll say, you know, we've got too much. We got to cut it down. We got to shorten it. We got to figure out what's most important to us. But when that process is all said and done, we'll print that up. We'll put it on the kids' lockers. We'll plaster it all over the place. And then what we find is those varsity guys will walk through a freshman practice and they'll see things and they'll tell me about it. Like, hey, they're not doing this. We need to get out about that. And they've taken this ownership stake that maybe they didn't have the opportunity to have if we didn't allow them to do that. Within that process, we also ask them flat out, you know, hey, what do you need from us as coaches? And I think when you have them in that spotlight on them and you have them in that situation, they're going to say all the right things. They may regret it later, but they're going to say all the right things. They're going to tell you, hey, we need you to hold us accountable. We need you to not let up on us on days where we don't feel like doing the work. We need you to remind us. And that's when you've got this golden opportunity to constantly remind them what they said they wanted to accomplish, but not be the bad guy. Hey, remember when you told me what my job was, right? I'm just doing my job here. You guys said you want to do these things. I'm supposed to hold you accountable. That's what we're doing here. And, so I think when you just make them stakeholders in the whole deal. You involve them in the process. You teach them the process. You let them take over the process. I think ultimately what you want to do is get them to set the goals that you want them to set, but make them believe it was entirely their idea, and that everything they're asking of you is you know, it's them. It's not me. It's entirely them. And I think that helps you avoid being the bad guy a lot at practice, not all the time, but I think, again, just involving them in that and in making them a part of that process is huge. And I've always been able to get kids pretty close to where get them to write down the things and say the things that I wanted them to say anyways. But now it's coming from them and not from me. So it's ultimately their team, not my team.
A little gentle guidance never hurts, right, Mike?
Absolutely.
Are you tired of slipping and sliding on the court and sticky sheets just aren't giving you grip? Grip Spritz solves this problem without having to lick your hand to clean your shoes. Grip Spritz is used by countless AAU, high school and college programs, semi-pro teams, as well as NCAA athletes and G League players. Unlike other products, Grip Spritz has solutions for individual players, not just entire teams. We've used Grip Spritz at our Head Start basketball camps and players love it. To keep you and your team from slipping and sliding, visit gripspritz.net to learn more. Another thing that you talk about in the book is dealing with players who have less than a stellar attitude. And you kind of kick off that section, though, by saying that you shouldn't take anyone else's opinion about what type of kid you're dealing with. You should figure it out for yourself instead of just, well, this guy told me that this player was a pain in the neck. Instead, go and meet the player, find out about the player, coach the player, get to know the kid, and find out really what they're all about. And if you do that, more often than not, you can figure out how to correct that attitude and get it moving in the right direction. Just talk a little bit about your experience of dealing with players whose maybe attitudes aren't where you want them to be. How do you mold and shape them and get them to come around to the team aspect of the game that we all know is so important to success on the court?
It's funny because last night was our middle school program. We have two teams at each level, seventh and eighth grade. So I was watching them play last night. They had their first games. And that's kind of where I always think of, like, hey, you know, you got this kid down to middle school. He's really talented, but you don't want him because he's got this bad attitude and this and that. And I've always thought, you know, first of all, if he's got a bad attitude on the court, he probably cares a lot. That's first and foremost. Like, I can never make a kid care more than he wants to care. But if a kid has an attitude on the court, it's probably because he cares. And when they're 13 and 14, how do you know anybody's ever taught them how to use that passion for something more positive? So I think sometimes we write kids off too soon. You know, you don't know what their home situation is. Is dad not at home? Is mom not at home? Maybe neither of them are at home. Maybe the kid's just pretty much on his own. There's just so many different things that can be happening in the kid's life right there. And number two, like I said, a year of growth in a kid from age 12 to age 18 is just incredible to see. It's unpredictable with kids, but it's fun to watch. And I just think just because the kid has an attitude doesn't mean he may not end up being your best leader by the time he's a senior. If we take him under our wing and coach him up on it a little bit and, you know, just teach him that. So how many times do we say if this kid with this talent had such and such as, you know, whoever's attitude or passion, you know, we say that all the time. Here's this kid with the passion, but he doesn't really know how to express it or use it. And we want to write him off, say, oh, you don't want that kid. He's got a bad attitude. So I just think you got to make your own decisions. Be careful what people tell you. And you know, don't forget these kids need the opportunity to grow up.
Absolutely. I think kids, so often when we think about as a coach or we think about it as a teacher, and we sometimes forget that I teach elementary school phys ed, and sometimes I'm dealing with a six-year-old kid that's driving me crazy. And sometimes you just forget. You're like, this kid's 6 years old. Like they're not out to get you. They're not trying to stick it to you. They just are having a bad day, or haven't figured out yet how to channel their emotions in a positive way. Or they're just, again, they're six, they're kids. And I think that is true all the way up through no matter what level you're coaching, because we're all human beings and we have good days and we have bad days. And I think if you can, as a coach, build the type of relationship that you've talked about up to this point with your players, then you're going to be able to have an impact. And can you reach every single kid? No. I mean, there's some kids that for whatever reason, they don't click with you and you can't get to them. But for the most part, I think if you take take an interest in a kid and you can figure out how to, as you said, take their passion that they have and channel it in the right direction, you're going to end up with something that may be surprising to you that you might not have expected, or certainly that somebody else who would be that person that's saying, hey, you know, you don't want to deal with this kid. His attitude is really bad. That might be surprising to them. And that's really what coaching is all about, is having an impact, sure, on the game of basketball, but you want that impact to carry on off the court, where you can help the kid to not only improve as a basketball player, but improve their life as well. Another section of the book, delegating to assistant coaches. We talked about it a little bit off the top of the pod and just how important that is to be able to delegate to assistant coaches. And Mike, you'd be, I'm sure, not that surprised. The number of coaches that have told us that I really became a successful coach when I stepped back and was actually doing less for my program and delegating more to my coaches and putting my faith in the people that I had hired and what they were able to do to improve the program. And that's when I knew I really had success. So talk a little bit about how your ability to delegate has evolved over the course of your coaching career.
I think, you know, one of the great things, I'm a big Notre Dame football fan. So there's some great stories there for coaches. Research Brian Kelly and the changes he made to the program. Gosh, what is that? Probably 4 or 5 years ago, where he stopped calling the plays. He stopped being the offensive coordinator. And he just stepped back and he let people do their jobs. And he was the head coach. And he's like, there was so much that I was missing because I was so, you know, my head was in this play sheet all the time. And I was missing the heartbeat of my team, the pulse of the team. So there's a lot to that. I was terrible at delegating early on because I had a certain standard and I didn't think anybody else could meet that standard. So I was afraid that, you know, when as head coaches, when we fail, it's on us. It's not on the assistant coaches. It's on us. And I had that fear. So I, you know, I had this standard and I didn't think anyone else could meet that standard. What I learned along the way as I became a parent and became busier and just trying to juggle it all was, I think I focused too much on what my assistant coaches couldn't do versus just seeing what they could do and finding a way to let them take that and run with it and be really good at it. Today, my assistant coaches run the weight. I don't even know what the weight room program is, to be honest with you. I know it's working. I know they're doing a great job. I know they mix it up a lot. I know so what I've done is I've looked at some things like in our program, lateral quickness is just kind of so-so. We get beat off the dribble too much. So we've really started adding a lot of band work, trying to improve our lateral movement. So I'm working on little nuances like that while they're running the basis, the main part of our weight program is entirely them. So I'm there, I show up, I get to be the assistant coach in the weight room. It's kind of fun. You know, I get to joke around with kids and, you know, I'll catch them in some technique stuff here and there and just kind of float around. And I have almost no responsibility. It's kind of nice, you know, and the kids know that our assistant coaches are in charge in there. And I think that demands more respect for them too. So it just ends up making our program stronger from top to bottom.
How do you view your responsibility as a head coach in helping to develop your assistants? Maybe if they eventually want to be head coaches, and assistant coaches come in all shapes, sizes, colors, and some coaches just want to continue to be assistant coaches. Yep. And they enjoy that role. And then there are other coaches who aspire to be a head coach. So how do you look at your responsibility to develop your staff and help them to grow as coaches so they can eventually get to where they want to get to in their career, whether that's being the best assistant they can be or whether that's taking over a program of their own eventually?
I'm in a really cool spot right now. I just hired two of my players that graduated last year to be my freshman assistant and sophomore assistant. That's a really cool thing for me because I was that age when I started. And I've got two guys that just played for me and they were just the best teammates and they're coaching nonstop. So that's really cool right now, getting to watch them interact with our guys and just remembering back where I was at that point. I think, you know, as a head coach, you got to know what assistants want. What do they aspire to be? You said some people are just happy being the assistant coach. You know, okay, if that's the case, tell me what you think your niche is, your specialty is, and we'll kind of work through that. And then we'll just try to build and add responsibility, you know, see what we can teach them. I think it's more important to get assistant coaches, especially at the high school level, who are good people first and foremost. I think, you get good people who are going to be loyal to you. You can teach them a lot of things that they need to know. So I think that's really important when hiring. But I don't treat them all the same way in terms of what I teach them because I know they don't all have those same aspirations. Kind of the same thing with your players. You got some guys that want to be college players. You got some that don't. So you just kind of know that. But I take it very seriously. I try to teach them as much as I possibly can. And now I just hand them my book. But before that, you know, it was, you know, we spend a lot of time together. I may be really the only one in the United States, but I don't watch game film after a game at night. If I don't care if we win by 30 or lose by 30 on a Friday night, I don't watch game film until Saturday anymore. Mm-hmm. I think the cool thing with things like Huddle is I can just upload it. I can take my staff and my family out to dinner. We'll talk about the game and whatever and just have a good time and just kind of blow off some steam. Now my head's a little clearer the next day when I come back to it. I've got the stats returned from Huddle, and then, you know, there's a lot of programs like Huddle that'll do that for you. And I just don't have that emotion attached to it. I always found I was just more efficient with that when I didn't have that emotion attached to it after the game. You know, the other part of that is I've coached over 500 and some games now. So I kind of feel like I've got a pretty clear picture when I leave the gym that night anyways. There's always stuff you don't see or you see from a different angle and things like that. But I just felt like I would go home. I would be too emotional. I'd watch the game film. I'd get more emotional. I wouldn't sleep. It just was so counterproductive. So, you know, like I said, I may be in the minority on that, but I don't touch the film on game night anymore. I just spend time with my family and my coaches and their families. And, you know, I think that's really important, I think. And that's where we talk about, you know, just a lot of the little things, the nuances of the game. And it's still an opportunity for me to coach my coaches, even if we're sitting at dinner and having a beer after a game.
How do you guys approach film work with your staff in terms of how much film is your assistant? How much film are your assistants watching? And then what do you guys share with your players? Obviously, you're watching a decent amount of film. Your assistant coaches probably are too. So just talk about your process for how you use film to make your team better.
I think every team's a little different. You get some teams that are really into film and some teams where it's like pulling teeth to get them to watch any film. So I think you have to, you know, really get a pulse on that as well. My assistant coaches, I've got a couple that watch a ton of film and some that probably never venture into Huddle at all. And that's, I'm okay with that too, because I'm going to watch a lot of the film myself. I've got my varsity assistant right now. He likes to be involved in the scouting report process. So I certainly, you know, let him be involved in that. We'll generally, our scouting reports, we'll share a Google Doc or something where we can both type into it and just kind of watch film simultaneously. It's kind of cool to see what he's seeing and comparing it to what I'm seeing and just comparing notes after that. He teaches at the middle school, so sometimes we can see each other typing into it during the day when we got breaks and stuff, and just kind of get together afterwards. And we share quite a bit. Our scouting reports they're not skinny. We give our kids everything, and you have to understand my mindset is that I'm going to give my kids every competitive advantage. You know, we're going to have strengths and weaknesses. We're going to have X's and O's. We're going to have tendencies. We're going to have keys to the game. You know, it's not uncommon with a conference opponent where they get a 10-page scouting report. And, you know, 10 pages is obviously that's with some X's and O's and stuff in there, which takes up more space. So it's not like it's all text, but, and we'll go through it with them. And we have very high expectations of them on that. I think, you know, I've always said that people who say, you know, we just scout ourselves or my mindset, I kind of do the eye roll, like you're just being lazy, because your job is to give your kids the best chance. Go back to what we said about how they only get a couple years to do this, and we've got to provide them with every opportunity. Not only that, I think, you know, just the preparation process teaches them once again a lot about life, this being prepared for every meeting, whatever it is they're doing for a living down the road. Just that preparation, you know, you show them how to do it. It's another opportunity to throw a life lesson at them.
How much time on the floor during practice do you dedicate to a specific opponent? So let's say you have a couple of days of practice leading into a conference game. How much practice time on the floor are you dedicating to showing what your opponent's going to be doing and dedicated to that scouting report?
We will, we'll take their probably the sets they run the most. It's a continuity, or if it's a couple quick hitters, whatever it is. And we'll walk through that and then we'll go through it live. We'll teach it to our scout team and, you know, probably spend maybe 15 minutes or so on that stuff. We'll walk them through based on out of bounds plays. You know, we'll again, I think kids are visual, so they want to see it on the floor. We'll actually have our starting five run their stuff too. Because I think they learn that way, you know, where the cuts are, all that other stuff is at. And so in our conference, we have some teams that are strictly, they don't really run any sets. So it's really more about personnel. And then we've got other teams that run a ton of sets. So it really depends on the opponent for us. I think it varies a little bit. But and then, you know, the process, though, for us is we're going to spend time on that. We're going to take away what they do best. I think at the high school level, if you can take away what they do best, you got a great chance to win, even if they're more talented than you are.
I think that's completely true. You think about a high school team's ability to adapt if you can shut down their best player or take their best actions away from them. I think you certainly give yourself a much better opportunity to be able to win, because when high school kids start going to their second or third option, they're usually not quite as good as that first option might be. To go along with that, how do you view the use of analytics, and what are some things that you've done in recent years to incorporate analytics into what you do from a coaching perspective? And what are some of the things that you think are really valuable that high school coaches should be looking at? What's a statistic or two that you really like that you think this stat impacts winning, and that's why we spend a lot of time looking at it?
I love analytics. I think, again, we have Huddle. Huddle is really popular in Illinois. I think it is in a lot of states. The things that you get for that, I think sometimes rebounding numbers can be misleading, I think, because of the pace of the game and things like that. So I like the percentage of offensive rebounds that your team's grabbing, the percentage of defensive rebounds. I like those better than just the pure numbers. I love e-field goal percentage, but I'll caution people on this. I think sometimes we can take analytics too seriously. And again, I love them. I think there's a lot of value in it for coaches. In Huddle, we can see what our best lineup was in the night. We can look at it by which five guys were on the floor, what was their plus minus and all that stuff. So there's a lot of cool stuff, and you can get lost in it. But the e-field goal percentage, I've heard coaches say you shoot layups or you shoot threes because everything else is bad for your e-field goal percentage. And at the high school level, I think that's a little harsh. I think that's a little extreme. I think we all have had teams where, our fourth and fifth option offensively at the high school level, the kid probably can't score off the dribble. The kid may not be able to shoot a three. The only thing he may be able to do offensively is knock down that mid-range shot that E field goal percentage is telling me is bad. But here's my byproduct there. If I allow him to knock that shot down, I probably get more out of him defensively. I probably get more out of the kid as a rebounder. I probably get more out of the kid as a screener. I just get so much more value out of that player. And if he's my fourth or fifth player, I need value out of that player. So don't let it be the end all be all to what you do. I think there's still place for the mid-range game, especially in high school basketball. I think at all levels, but I think especially high school basketball, just because you've got kids whose skill sets are limited. And you want their best efforts, and sometimes you gotta trust them to make a shot here and there. And you can tell them they're not the number one option or number two option or whatever, and be brutally honest with them on that stuff. But if they can make a 12 to 17 footer, and that's gonna help allow you to get a lot more out of them across the board and in every other aspect of the game, you gotta let them do that.
That's the James Harden Houston Rockets corollary right there.
It is.
When James Harden dribbles around for 22 seconds, and the only time you're one of those other four guys that you get the ball is when he gets stonewalled and has to give it to you with 2 seconds on the shot clock so you can touch the ball for half a second and chuck up a shot that's probably completely contested.
Oh, hey, Mike, you've ruined it, Mike. Mike's going to talk about James Harden for like 25 minutes now.
No, I won't. I promise. I promise.
He's going to get on a James Harden rant.
Hey, you said I ruined it. I didn't even bring it up. Mike did.
That's right. It's just, I think about that particular style of play, and yeah. I think you brought up the fact that, look, those other guys have to want to, let's face it, basketball – the reason why we get into it as players is not so that we can stand around and watch some other guy dribble and then go back to the other end and play 24 seconds of hard defense. That's not why anybody starts to play. And clearly there's a hierarchy on teams, and I get it. Your best offensive players are going to get the most shots, and I understand that. But I think, especially when you talk about high school kids, if you're not going to allow a kid to do anything except shoot threes and get to the rim, I think you're pigeonholing a lot of kids. And I see so many teams that they've got guys shooting threes who, in all honesty, have no business shooting threes. And look, well, I'll understand that. I get it that three is worth more than two, but not every kid is a 3-point shooter. And look, sometimes, as you said, you're fortunate enough that you get that group where you have six or seven kids that can knock down a three. but you're going to have other years where you might only have one or two kids that, in all honesty, those are the kids you want shooting threes. And everybody else, when they do take one, you're kind of cringing like, ooh, man, I don't know if I want them taking that shot. And so you got to give kids an opportunity to do what they do well. And then, as you said, maybe they cut harder on offense. Maybe they play a little bit harder on defense. Maybe they sprint a little bit more in transition because they know that they're going to touch the ball and they're going to get to do some stuff versus you're telling them, look, you're not a three-point shooter and you can't get to the rim. So all you're going to do is play defense and set screens. That's not any fun for any kid.
No, it's not. All right. I think there's a lot to that. I think you got your roster is what it is. The high school level, we can't get out and recruit guys. So again, we got to put their strengths to work for us.
I want to talk a little bit about how you design your practices and your planning process, and then how you go about making sure that you keep things competitive. I know from the book that you're a big proponent of keeping score and drills. So maybe talk a little bit about how you plan your practices and then why you feel it's so important to keep score when you're in practice.
I think first of all, the practice planning for us, our first drill is called perfection, and it's four really basic offensive drills back to back to back. It's three man weave, it's three man straight, it's a two man passing, it's a rebound outlet drill, fill the lane for a layup. But we call it perfection because they can't make any mistakes. They fumble a pass, they throw it away, they miss a layup. We started over at the first drill, and they've got 6 minutes to get through that and be perfect. And for us, it's some days it's 3 minutes, some days it's 6 minutes, but it's just a lot of really basic fundamentals to get practice going. They've got to communicate through the drill, but they've got to compete right off the bat. Like they don't want to run at the end. At the end of the 6 minutes, we'll have something for them. May just be a down and back. It's not really about what that is. It's just about the fact that they lost in that particular drill. But we want their mindset. We want them razor sharp and competing right from the get go. Just doing simple things. And at the varsity level, we still need to talk about bounce passes to cutters for layups, things like that. So it's our opportunity to emphasize that. But we jump straight from that right to defense. We'll do all of our defensive breakdown drills in about 20 minutes. We do most of the same ones every day. There's only about four different ones that we'll use. And in the past, I've used a lot of different ones, but we'll jump right into that. And as soon as we jump into our defensive breakdown drills, you'll see coaches that have a weighted ball. We've got a ball that's about 3.5 pound ball that each coach has underneath their arms. And as soon as a kid misses an assignment, we just call their name and toss them the ball. And as they take off, we'll tell them why. Most usually they know why, but it's just a part of our culture where, we demand perfection in terms of positioning defensively, communication defensively, all that stuff. So that 20-minute segment is pretty intense. There's usually a kid running around the court with the ball above his head, maybe twice around the court. Again, it's not a killer thing. It's just that reminding them of what the expectation is. From there, we round out the first half of practice with a lot of offensive breakdown drills, shooting, ball handling. We have two guns usually set up at practice. The coaches out there, if you don't have shooting machines, man, you got to find a way to fundraise and get them, because the efficiency that they bring to practice is just incredible. And then usually halftime for us is free throws. So we're at an hour and 10 minutes. Free throws is kind of like that. Just kind of, catch your breath a little bit, but shoot them while you're tired, get a drink, come back. And then we'll have a quick talk like we do at halftime. This is kind of where we're at. This is what the emphasis is, the second half of practice. This is what's going well. This is what we need to change. And for us, the second half of practice is going to be a lot more 5-on-5 stuff, game situation stuff, might include some scouting report stuff. But that's where we get into, I just think if you're not keeping score in everything you do in practice, you really need to. The scoreboard should be on if you have that ability to turn the scoreboard on. There should be a time running on a drill. Like we tell them we're doing this defensive breakdown drill for 4 minutes. Do it for 4 minutes and get the heck out of it, no matter how bad it is. I think the clock is important because we play games with clocks on, right? I mean, we got to finish the quarter. We got to finish the fourth quarter. It's an opportunity when there's 30 seconds on the clock to just really push them to finish real strong and just mimic what we're going to do in a game. So the scoreboard's always on. We're always keeping score. In scrimmages, I think it took me a while to figure this out, and it's really just super, super simple. If I watch game film on Saturday and we're terrible at offensive rebounding, the effort's just not there. Part of that's probably coming back to I didn't emphasize it enough throughout the week. So when we're scrimmaging on Monday in practice, we're gonna give them 2 points for an offensive rebound. You know, maybe we're giving the defense a point per deflection. Maybe we're not screening very well. So now coaches are gonna just judge the screens. If it's a solid screen, we'll give them a point. If it's a bad screen, we don't give them a point. So the end of a possession, you know, one possession might be worth, in some days, one possession might be worth 11, 12, 13 points. And, you know, the game gets up in the hundreds pretty quickly when we play. And, but it's just the opportunity to emphasize, again, it's not what you teach, it's what you emphasize, right? It's your opportunity to score. Kids are competitive. So if you tell them these are the rules, all right, I guess if that's what we got to do to scrimmage, we'll do it. And they want to win. So if you're not finding, you're not rewarding actions with points in practice, I think you're missing opportunities to get better.
I think that was a great point that you made in the book, and you just reiterated it there about your kids really want to scrimmage. I mean, that's what they want to do. You think about any kid at any age, the most universal question you get, especially if you're a new coach or you come in, I know I think about just the number of my own kids' teams that I've coached AAU and travel and rec basketball. And you come in, what's the first thing that kid walks through the door? Hey, coach, when are we going to scrimmage? Are we scrimmaging tonight? Are we going to scrimmage? And that's what they want to do. And your point is well taken, that because that desire to scrimmage is so high, you can get them to do just about anything to if they get to scrimmage. And so by putting them in situations where, hey, we're going to scrimmage, but yeah, you get 2 points for an offensive rebound and you get points for deflections, or you get points if you take a charge, or you get points for setting a good hard ball screen and rolling to the basket, whatever it is that you're trying to emphasize. I think that's a really, really great coaching point and teaching point that any coach who's out there listening, if you can incorporate that into what you do, whether you do it in a 5-on-5 scenario or whether you do it in a small sided game and you're working 3-on-3, and maybe you just want to work on some actions that are part of your offense, or maybe you want to work on some actions that your opponents are going to throw at your team, you can do all that and reward the types of behaviors and the types of things that you're looking for. But as we've said a couple times, you've got to make sure that you know what you want to emphasize and be intentional about what it is that you're looking for, what you're teaching, because then that's what you're going to get. And if you don't throw out what it is that you're looking for, I know you said a couple times in the book that scrimmaging can sometimes look like free time. And that's how kids sometimes approach it if you don't provide a structure as a coach. And I think that's really, really important.
And one other thing we do besides keeping score is we'll have days where, you know, maybe it was a bad turnover game where we have three coaches in there that while we're scrimmaging, each coach has a ball. As soon as they turn one over, we take that ball away. We throw the second ball out. They turn that one over. We throw the third ball out. And so it's a visual. All three balls are gone. Now we just got to run for whatever time is left on the clock. So if that was an 8-minute quarter we were scrimmaging, there's 4 minutes on the clock, we're going to get some conditioning. You know, we may put a ball in our hand and do some dribble suicides or whatever, but just it's amazing what you can do to get them to focus when you put those parameters in.
Yeah, I love that idea. I never heard that one before, of taking a ball off the rack and having that be a way to visualize the turnover situation. I think that's a great way to go about it, because as you said, it provides a concrete look at what's actually happening. And then boom, they know the consequences if they're not doing the things that they need to do. And your book is filled with a bunch of great tips like that from a practice standpoint and figuring out how to do those kinds of things. As you said off the top, it's not necessarily X's and O's. You're not going to find a bunch of out of bounds plays and that kind of thing, but you are going to find a ton about how to run your program the right way and how to build your culture. One of the other things that you talked about was, and it's something that's become ever more important in the high school game as a high school coach, is your ability to work with AAU basketball and travel basketball, because it's something that the way basketball is here in the United States, as a high school coach, you're going to have to figure out how to best navigate that to help your players. And I just wanted you to have an opportunity to talk about how you've handled that to make sure that your players are getting the most out of their experience with you, and conversely, how you can help them to get the best of their experience with AAU and travel basketball.
I was in a hospitality room. I think this was back in 2004 when I was at Rockford Jefferson, and we were playing in an NCAA certified shootout for high school, which those are rare these days. But and it was a Friday, And on Saturday, a bunch of our kids, this was July now, and a bunch of our kids were, you know, they wanted to go play in an AAU tournament. And I always came back to like, all right, they're playing, and some of them are going to play against some really good competition. If they're gone, other guys get to play. You know, we should be able to make this work to where we get better as a result of it. But I was in this hospitality room. I was talking to Gordy Kirkman. Gordy's a Hall of Fame coach here in Illinois, Western Rural High School. And I have a ton of respect for Gordy. And as a young coach, I just said, Coach, I said, what do you do when your guys want to go play AAU and you've already got a tournament schedule? Like, how do you handle that? And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, I tell them if they leave and they go play with their AAU team, they can never come back. And I just kind of thought, here I am like, man, I love this guy. I think he's a great coach, but there's just got to be a better way. You know, it is part of the culture. It's not going away. Scheduling wise, you know, we schedule all of our summer, 25 days. We schedule most of them in June so that our guys that are our travel team, AAU guys, can go play in July because that's a big time for them. I know that I'm being bypassed in the college recruitment process. I used to love that with our guys. Met a lot of great coaches that way, a lot of big name coaches, just because I had some good players through the years and really enjoyed that part of it. I also know that, like, listen, if I'm a trainer, if I were a trainer, you know, you see them on social media, right? You see these trainers showing video clips of their clients, their kids, performing these high level moves, right? But they don't teach them some of the most basic fundamentals. And I get it. Like, it's an advertising thing. It's a marketing thing. Why would you not put that video out there? And then everybody's like, yeah, I want my kid doing that stuff. So they sign them up and they do come back with some really high level skill stuff. But in the process, some things get bypassed. And I think that happens to a lot of AAU teams as well. Not all of them, but some of them. So I just think, again, as a high school head coach now, I've just got to be really observant of what my guys are, you know, where their improvements are and where the holes are in their game. So I think at the varsity level, it's a really long way to say this, but at the varsity level, there are, I think I do more stuff that I did when I was coaching freshmen to fill in some of those gaps. But at the same time, these kids are so far advanced in other things that I don't have to spend a lot of time on that stuff. If that, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's just changed the way we approach practice, scheduling, really everything. And, you know, I don't think it's been, there's a negative stigma there, and I don't think there has to be. I just think we have to be willing to try to coexist.
How much do you try to build relationships with the better AAU programs in your area to sort of help to facilitate your kids getting into a good situation? Cause I tell parents, and I have conversations with people all the time that come to me for advice about where they should play and this and that. And for me, it always comes down to, well, what's the coach going to do during your practices? Are you going to be learning the game, or are we just rolling the ball out and playing glorified pickup basketball with somebody standing on the sideline and a couple of refs running up and down the floor? So how do you go about building relationships with AAU programs to make sure that your kids are getting the right experiences?
I don't do that as much as I used to be honest. And it's not, part of that is where I'm at in life and just being busy with other things. But I do talk to kids about the fact that, like, you know, make sure you spend a lot of money, make sure you're going to get better. Like, look at this. You know, I know you like it if they just roll the ball out some days, but is that really where you want to get is that any value for what you're spending in terms of it? You know, are you going to be a better player as a result of that? I always tell parents, like, you know, be careful, because I think so much of these AAU programs, you can have a program that has a great reputation, but your son or daughter may end up playing for a particular coach in that program who's just not very good.
Absolutely.
And therefore, that experience for that kid is not going to be great, even though there's been a ton of other kids who have had a great experience in that program. The opposite can also be true. You can have a program that doesn't have a great reputation, but maybe their 16-year coach is a younger guy or a new guy, or he's just really good in general. And if you're on that team, you could have a great experience. So it's really about, do your research. I kind of tell them I kind of give them the job interview stuff. Like, you're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you. You go to a tryout, ask questions, be observant. How organized is it? All of that stuff. But, you know, there's a lot of good programs that have some bad coaches. There's a lot of bad programs that have some good coaches. And
it's funny, Mike, because
a little bit of a crapshoot. You got to do your research.
Absolutely. It's funny that you say that, because
what the way you phrased it is exactly the way that I've phrased it to so many people that I've talked to. You can be with a great organization and get the one bad coach in that organization and have a terrible experience. And conversely, you could be with an organization that other people will tell you is terrible, and you can get that one great coach in that organization and you can have a terrific experience. And it really does come down to the coach, and are they going to teach the game, and are they going to make sure that they're in it for the right reasons, which is to benefit the kid. And I think really ultimately, whether you're a high school coach or you're an AAU coach, if your ultimate goal is to do what's right by the player, then that's where we want to be. Whether no matter which side of that equation we're on, whether we're on the AAU side or on the high school side, if both sides are trying to do what's best for the player and not what's best for them selfishly as the high school coach or as the AAU coach or the AAU program, then that's where we're going to end up in a spot where we all want to be, where we're going to be able to have a positive impact on the kid as a player. And as we've talked about numerous times tonight, as a human being. All right. I want to wrap up with a final two-part question and then give you another opportunity to plug the book. Two-parter. First part, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what's the biggest challenge that you have in front of you? And then number two, what's the biggest joy that you feel when you wake up in the morning and you get to go in and you get to be the head coach at Harlem High School? What's your biggest joy? So biggest challenge, biggest joy.
Biggest challenge for me right now is something I've never done before, and that's coach my own kid, you know. I've coached him for years, you know, travel ball and stuff like that. But this is a little different. You know, the spotlight's on a little bit more in a high school gym on a Friday night or whatever it is. So, and I think when I say that's a challenge, it's not him, it's me. And it's me making sure that I think the best advice I've gotten on this came from a good friend of mine. He was an assistant coach of mine at one point, and he's a head coach in our league right now. But he said, you know, you just got to make sure you coach them the same. You know, if you get pumped up when other kids take a charge, you got to get pumped up when your kid takes a charge. You can't just be like, well, I expect him to do that because he's my kid. So that's a challenge. It's something that I think some coaches out there probably can relate to it because they've coached their own sons or daughters before. For me, that's a new challenge. So that's something I'm looking forward to. I don't know if he's looking forward to it or not, but I have to do a better job of coaching him the same way I coach the other guys. I can't be harder on him because he misses a layup. It is what it is. It's the same mistake everybody else makes. One of the things I just love about being a coach, I am super observant. I don't know if other coaches do this. Maybe this is just a quirky thing that I have. I love watching game film when our guys make a great play, whatever it is. I love watching. I rewind it and I watch the reactions of fans in the stands. You know what I mean? I don't know if you've ever done that or not, but for me, it's that reminder that we have this incredible opportunity to bring joy into people's lives, whether it be 90 minutes or whatever it is. And we talk to our kids about that. I talk to my players about that a lot, just taking that very seriously. Like, people paid to watch you play tonight. You know, they've got difficult things going on in their lives, and this is their escape. You know, what are you going to give them tonight? What are you going to show them tonight? And I think that's a huge privilege that we have, that people come to watch what we do to escape from whatever it is that they have that's difficult, that's going on in life. And it's something I'll never take for granted.
I love that. It's a great reminder for coaches, for players, just to think about, hey, somebody is coming in this gym, paying their hard-earned money to come and watch you play. I think back to that Michael Jordan quote of, you never know that somebody's going to be there, right? It might be the only time they ever get to see me in person. And I got to make sure that they're getting the true Michael Jordan experience. And I don't know how many guys in the game all the way through. I mean, we know there are guys that still do that today, and we know there are some guys that don't do that. But I think if you could take that attitude into every single game that, hey, this might be the only time this person is going to be in the stands to see me play, and I want to make sure that I show them who I really am and give my best effort. And it's a great way to frame that. All right.
Before and I've used exactly that before. That exact clip that you're talking about from that Michael Jordan interview. Yeah, I've used that exact same thing with our kids before. So that was a great add on to that.
So before we get out, I want to give you a chance one more time. Pitch the book. Tell people where they can find out more about it, where they can order it. Give them the title again. Let's go through all that. Share your own social media, how people can connect with you if they want to reach out after listening to the episode. And after you do all that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
All right. So the book is called The Journey, Lessons from the Hardwood. It's everything I've learned in 27 years, sometimes through successes, sometimes through failures. It's available everywhere. It's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, my website, CoachWinners.com. It's actually on sale there right now, so it's a little cheaper there if you order from CoachWinners.com. It's one of those things. You said it's an easy read. I've had a lot of people tell me that. It just kind of flows. The reviews have been good on it. We just got to get the word out that it's something that I think can really help people. So I'm excited about it. Love to get the opportunity to talk about it. Can't thank you guys enough for that opportunity here tonight. And, looking forward to hear some feedback from some of your listeners as well.
As I said, both on the podcast and before we jumped on, I love the book. It reads honestly for those people who are a regular part of our audience here on the Hoopheads Pod. The book reads very similar to an episode of the Hoopheads Podcast where Mike dives into a little bit of his backstory. We learn about him. We learn about his family. We learn a little bit about his experiences at his various jobs. And then he dives into the nitty gritty of what it means to be a high school basketball coach and build a program. There's just a lot of great wisdom in there that, as he said, he's built up over his 27 year career that he's shared. So if you get an opportunity to go out and pick up a copy of the book, please make sure you do so. Mike, we cannot thank you enough for jumping on with us tonight, taking the time out of your schedule to share with our coaching audience, to share a little bit about your book. Congratulations. It's very, very well done. And thank you for taking the time to speak with us about it tonight. To everyone out there who's part of our audience, we appreciate you listening and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.